I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine. I'm Levy Dalton, and this is All Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the wine business. Dan Keeling on the show today. He is the co-founder and co-owner of Noble Rot Magazine, the Noble Rot Wine Bars and Restaurants, as well as Keeling, Andrew & Co., and also the retail shop Shrine to the Vine in London. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hi, Levy.
You were born in London, but you moved out of there when you were three.
So I was born in a place called Watford, which is just on the outskirts of London. My wife likes to say that the whole family are from London, except for me. And then we moved out to Buckinghamshire. And I go to Buckinghamshire. It doesn't really feel like home. I don't know what it is. I wanted to get out straight away, and I went to Manchester Polytechnic, which became Manchester Metropolitan University, and it was an art course, but I was the only person on my course who didn't have a foundation in art because I was so desperate to get out of where I was and get to the city. And Manchester was this kind of holy land, or an unholy land, maybe. When I went to college, and I remember going into town and having a bank card for the first time and thinking, well, I can actually spend money on an overdraft, and thinking, what am I going to spend it on? And it was records and curry. There was a place called This and That Cafe, which is still like one of my all-time favorite restaurants, which is, you'll go there, it's in a back alley of kind of the Northern Quarter, and you can get a curry and three types of curry and rice for like £6 or £7, but it's just the most beautiful home-cooked style. So that was kind of an obsession at that time, was good curry.
When you were a kid, your dad used to make a good curry.
My dad would cook occasionally, but not very much, but he'd make a big song and dance when he did. And our next door neighbor was, he was an Indian guy who could cook. So he kind of showed him how to do it. But my dad got it right sometimes and he got it wrong other times. But there would be a bit of a kind of drama if we dared to say that we didn't like the curry when he cooked it.
Your mother cooked, but then like me, sometimes it was also the frozen food circuit as a kid.
Oh, absolutely. You know, my mum was a head teacher of a school, so she would cook when she was there, but sometimes I'd come home and, you know, they wouldn't be around. So it was a time of Findus, kind of crispy pancakes, and something called lean cuisine, which was kind of boil in the bag. I don't know if you had it in America, but boil in the bag dishes, which I've later found out Michel Gerard, the chef, he was involved apparently in kind of making some of these lean cuisine recipes because he did Cuisine Mansur. So it was a time of nouvelle cuisine, and that kind of manifested itself in kind of processed food as well. So there was some not so bad stuff, but you know, frozen pizzas, they're never very good, but you may do in the 80s with processed food.
One of the things I recognized in you was that you liked food. I was like, oh, this guy likes food. It's a way of talking about it.
Food is one of those things. I mean, some people maybe don't look forward to their next meal as much as I do or you do, but I can't imagine that. And I know that when you're in Italy or a real food culture like that, then the whole family is obsessed by mealtimes, and it's about getting the family around the table. It's a social and cultural thing as much as a gastronomic thing. And maybe that hasn't got so much of a culture for that in Great Britain. But I think a lot of people here are obsessed by food. I mean, there's not that many things to be obsessed by, you know, maybe your family, maybe football, maybe sex, maybe alcohol, I don't know. But food is up there. It's one of the greatest pleasures. I can get quite addicted to certain foods as well. And I think I've go through periods of like obsessing about certain foods and wanting to eat them all the time. And some foods make you feel better than other foods, obviously.
When did music start to become a profession for you?
So when I moved to Manchester, I started writing for Melody Maker, which was a sister publication of NME. And I was writing about electronic music. And there was a magazine called Jockey Slut, which is a fanzine about electronic music that got set up around the same time. And I started writing about house and electronic kind of music and techno from Detroit and stuff like that around that time. And it was really to meet the musicians. I really wanted to kind of find out more about the music and learn more about it. So it was at college that it started to really kind of kick off. And a friend, my best friend, Alex, he cut the top of his finger off in a factory on a guillotine. And he got a payoff of like £2,000. We were amazed and we were thinking, right, you can move to Manchester now and we can open a nightclub with £2,000. So we started to get plans together for this kind of conceptual nightclub. And we had people over from Detroit, like Juan Atkins, Kenny Larkin. And, you know, we would DJ ourselves and there'd be a couple of DJs from Manchester. And some nights would be really popular and others would be really quiet. And I can remember not being able to pay Kenny Larkin's manager and having to kind of say, we're really sorry, we're just students, we don't know what we're doing, but we're really into your music. So that was a learning curve.
How did it feel for you to be writing about music? Because I feel like writing about music is kind of like writing about wine. It, you know, it's difficult to really bring it home.
Frank Zappa said that quote that, you know, writing about music is like dancing about architecture, which is a quote I often come back to, because trying to describe smells and ethereal kind of sensations, very, very hard. And I think that's where a lot of wine writing maybe falls down, is about trying to be too prescriptive about that. Because everyone has got their own different interpretation of smells and colors and all these things. But so it's really about trying to write about the feeling that these things give you, rather, and, you know, a cultural thing as well, and trying to find some insight as well. And that comes after you're a bit more experienced, that you can join dots together between different parts of wine, or wine with music, or that with food, and give people some kind of insight about why these things matter.
You took a hobby, which was going to clubs and listening to music, and you made that a profession where you got a paycheck.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, I've kind of done that again with food and wine and music, and not everyone does that, and I really appreciate that, and I feel very fortunate that it's happened for me, because there were certainly times before I got a job in record companies or before we started Noble Rot when that might not have happened. But you have to put yourself in the position where it can happen, and then with a bit of good timing and good people around you, it does happen.
You often have pursued the kind of business that people say, oh, you're not going to make any money in that. Oh, that's hard. That industry is going to eat you up and spit you out. You've often found yourself doing exactly those things.
I met a few A&R guys, and I remember one of them saying, you know, don't do A&R. You'll never get a job, firstly. And once you get a job, you'll never have a hit. So that was quite a common thing. And then after I came out of the record companies and I was really didn't want to continue in my music career and I wanted to do something with wine and food, I had some friends saying, well, you know, you've had one good career in music. What's the likelihood of you doing a second one? And it was like the odds are stacked against you. But if I'd listened to those people, who I respect their opinions, but you can't listen to people. You have to get on with doing what you want to do. And it happened again and in a different way. And again, I think it comes back to meeting the right people. And the people you work with have to connect with kind of your view on how you want things run.
Back to the A&R days, Parlophone. How did that happen and what happened when you were there?
So I was at A&M Records before as a talent scout. I was there for a year and a half. I learned some good stuff there, but A&M was not a hip label. And they had people like Brian Adams. And it was a good time, but it was getting my feet under the table of a record company for the first time was a huge learning curve. You know, I'd come down from Manchester. My boss, the day I started, he basically pointed to the telephone and said, there's a telephone, pointed to a sack of demos, said, there's a demo. He says, right, find us an artist. I'm going to New York. And he went off to New York later that morning. And so I remember picking up a Volkswagen, what did I have, was it a Golf? And it was the first time I'd ever driven alone, ever, because I had to pass my driving test to get the job. And that was the scariest kind of thing I've ever done in my life, except for maybe LSD, which I had to drive from Fulham to Kilburn, which should take about half an hour in traffic. It took me 3 hours. I remember my feet like kind of shaking on the clutch going around Hyde Park Corner. So it's a big learning curve. And, you know, I didn't know a lot of London. I didn't know New King's Road where A&M Records was. I didn't know that area. I didn't know all the different venues you have to go to. I didn't know the managers you had to speak to. I didn't know. There's so many things that you need to know. And that year and a half was just trying to find my bearings. It was a very hedonistic industry. Like A&R, record label at that time, is a very hedonistic place to be. But as much as, you know, that old kind of cliche about work hard, play hard, it was pretty life and death stuff about getting shit done. And if you didn't do it, you know, you would be out. It wouldn't be like it is today where, you know, there's so much more onus put on like good practice in the workplace. Like those old record companies were lawless, kind of weird places run by nutcases. And it taught you to be resilient, because if you weren't resilient, then you're not going to get on and make sense. I mean, the flip side to that, there was a lot of amazing people in record companies as well, but there was a few psychos, and like, you know, the psychos rose to the top. It's like politics. And then PolyGram, who owned A&M at the time, were, what was happening? I think A&M was getting folded, and then PolyGram got bought by Universal. It was this kind of musical chairs, which is always going on in the music industry. And I was going to be without a job. So there was an opening at Parlophone Records, and Parlophone Records at that time was the Rolls Royce of English record labels. It had the Beatles catalog, it had the Beach Boys, it had Radiohead, OK Computer just come out, which was kind of my target of what I wanted to do in A&R, was to sign a band with the credibility and the commercial kind of the success of Radiohead. Kylie Minogue just got signed and had Can't Get You Out of My Head. There was Blur. I mean, the roster was incredible. And the people working there were really good as well, and had a very good reputation as, and people always say this, kind of an artist kind of label. But it really did. It was, you know, it didn't put too much pressure on artists. It kind of went about things in a way where they could have a long career rather than just trying to ram it down people's throats. So getting the job there, I remember, I mean, I don't believe in God, but I remember praying, thinking, I really want a job at Parlophone. And I got a job at Parlophone, and the MD of the label was a guy called Keith Wozencroft, and Keith's still a very good friend, and he'd signed Radiohead. So I was always a bit in awe of Keith. I mean, I still am, of course, but I remember saying to him, Keith, you signed Radiohead. How do you go about signing a band like that? And, you know, Keith's very relaxed, and he was just saying, you know, just kind of relax and get out there and walk around, and, you know, you'll bump into something, which is all very easy to say. And then, you know, a year and a half later, the first band I signed was Coldplay. So that was a great start. And Coldplay, most of them were a year younger than I was. So it wasn't like being a 45-year-old A&R man who was 20 years older than the people he signed. I was their age. So I kind of went on the start of that journey with them a lot, and kind of their ascent was steep and global as well. So it was really a fun time.
But at first, you didn't think much of them. When you first heard them, you were like, eh.
No, I remember the first demo tape I got was called Ode to Deodorant. It sounded like an average school band. There was nothing remarkable about it. And then I went to see a gig. And at that time, I used to have to go and see five bands a night. And you'd drive around from Camden to, you know, to the centre of town and wherever we needed to go around the country. You know, you'd go to Leeds at the drop of a hat and then drive back. And it was the end of the night, and I think I was a bit tired, and there was about 20 people in Cairo Jacks, and Chris Martin had a very baggy student jumper on. Guy, the bass player, had like a stonewashed denim jacket, which was, you know, I don't think would have even been cool in 1985. And Chris was handing out curly whirlies down the front of the gig to his mates from UCL. And I remember thinking, God, the Rolling Stones would never do that. That is so uncool. And then trying to kind of get out of the venue as quick as possible. A few months later, I was in Manchester again, and I went to see a good friend of mine who signed their publishing after this, and she had their new demo, which is called Bigger Stronger. And Bigger Stronger was so much better than the first demo that I'd heard. It did sound very derivative. It sounded like Jeff Buckley meets kind of a Pink Floyd mid-late with a touch of Radiohead. So you could see the influences, but it was so well done. And that thing of playing something over and over and over again, I would, you know, I'd be playing it 10 times in the car on the way back to Manchester. Then, you know, I'd play it when I was in bed, then I'd get up and I'd play it. And I was thinking, shit, this band have really improved. I need to get back in there. And it was a Saturday morning after I heard it on the Friday. And I called the manager and I said, you know, I love the new demo. It'd be great to meet up and talk about, you know, a plan of what you want to do. Where are you? And he was at the bottom of my street in Hoxton. So in East London, when I lived over in East London 25 years ago, and he was there with the bass player. So I kind of got down there sharpish and then had a few beers and then kind of went from there and tried to woo them to Parlophone, which I did have an advantage because Parlophone was such an amazing label. And I think any band would have wanted to be on that roster at that time. I haven't listened to Parachutes for a long time, but it has the power comes from its simplicity. It's like a lot of music, a lot of art. And, you know, they've developed into a very different band now. But as we know, most artists, the first 10 years is when they make the big kind of key works that are going to stay in the kind of popular canon for the rest of time.
Yeah, people say Joshua Tree's a pretty good album from U2, for example.
I think it did all right, didn't it?
What do you think separated, say, Coldplay from other bands like Athlete that you also signed? Like, some are interesting bands that do okay, and some are mega hit, multi-platinum.
Yeah, I think what separates them is hairs on the back of the neck moments. You know, that's every great band. You know, you listen back to your favorite music and it instantly can transport you somewhere. The hairs lift on the back of your neck and you feel the energy, and that can be, like, you know, the change from a chorus into a middle eight, or, you know, those kind of moments, I think, in songs where you have something unexpected happens that just gives you a very kind of a big feeling, whatever the feeling is. Also, I think it's about songwriters have to be able to incorporate more than one emotion into a song. You know, if you think of, you know, Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses, it has a real sense of longing, but it also has a euphoria about it. And I think that Coldplay and Chris Martin were very good at doing that. And then beyond that, vocals, you know, the voice. And Chris Martin has a distinctive vocal. It's like listening to Elton John. You know straight away it's them. And there's something that draws you in that makes it intimate, no matter if it's like they're playing in a stadium or wherever they're playing. It has an intimacy about it. So you've got to get all these things, and you've got to write consistently good songs, which Chris never drank. I don't know if he drinks now, but at the time he would always be away when the rest of the band would be in the pub. He'd be writing songs, and he was obsessed by music and getting better, and his obsession is what really drove that band. And I think if you don't have the obsession, you're never going to be that big. It has to be everything in.
Sometimes going all in works out great, and sometimes things fall apart anyway.
So it was going from mega success to, you know, back to square one quite quickly.
That's after this message. I talk to winemakers all the time, and something they tell me is that oxygen management is a key to aging wine. Finding the right balance is crucial, and that's why I recommend DM's revolutionary cork closures. With DM corks, winemakers can achieve precisely controlled oxygen management after a bottle leaves the winery, ensuring a wine that matures gracefully and reaches its full potential. With over 2 billion DM corks sold each year, It's clear that winemakers worldwide trust DM for consistent results. And DM has recently expanded the permeability options for their popular DM10 and DM30 closures, providing winemakers with even more flexibility to choose a cork that will guarantee the kind of wine life they envision. Banish surprise dud bottles and embrace DM closures. Your customers will thank you. In North America, DM products are exclusively distributed by G3 Enterprises. Ready to ensure the lifespan of your wines? Go to dm-closures.com/IDTT to learn more. That's diam-closures.com/IDTT for more information. That became, in a way, your calling card when you were handpicked to become managing director at Island Records?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd been headhunted, for want of a better word, by Lucien Grange, who's now chairman of Universal Worldwide. And I didn't really want to leave EMI Parlophone because I had such a great roster, but they were being bought by Guy Hans, and the shit was going to start hitting the fan there. And Lucien made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, as they say in the movies.
There was a kind of a shift there, because U2, which was a huge band for Island Records, and it actually owned a part of Island Records at one point, was leaving. And they were going to go to Mercury Records, which is another part of the Universal Music Group. And you were coming in, and you were kind of tasked with finding the next U2 in short order.
Yeah, and trying to find a hit straight away is a high-pressure job. And, you know, you get paid money. You get paid a good amount of money. But A&R, when you're having success, you're a genius. And when you've got no success, you're an idiot. So it's a good life lesson, A&R. And leaving behind my artist that I had at EMI, which was, you know, Coldplay, Athlete, had a number one. And just as I left, I signed Lily Allen with a friend of mine who bought her in Jamie Nelson. And that was another hit. Your life is so much easier when you've got hits as an A&R person. You can pretty much do no wrong. So it was going from mega success to, you know, back to square one quite quickly. And then after a couple of years, the financial crisis hit. And when you're a big company and the financial crisis hits, you streamline and, you know, who can you get rid of? And I was on a lot of money. And I'd signed Bombay Bicycle Club, which were a good band, but certainly not like commercially, you know, big. So it was time to leave. But I had 2 years left on my deal, so they paid me off.
And you had met your wife at Island Records?
Yeah. So my first day at Island Records, I put my good clothes on. I don't know why, but the first person I met, other than the guy that was showing me round, who was actually the MD at the time, but who was going to become president, took me into the marketing department, and Naomi was there. So, yeah, there you go. I obviously knew something because, you know, I had my smart white trousers on.
And you used to take her around in a black Aston Martin, and your dad had used to have been an Aston Martin mechanic.
You know, I had the disposable income, and I was 30, bought a Porsche, bought an Aston Martin. People thought I was a right wanker. You know, of course you would at 30 years old, but I got that out of my system. But buying the sports car thing, I guess deep down probably was about my father's love for cars. And I like cars a lot, but he was obsessed by cars. So that was really his thing. And I'd grown up around Aston Martins as well. So primary school, he might come and pick me up in a DB5 Vantage convertible that he's doing up for somebody else. You know, we weren't a rich family, but he would be doing up cars for rich families. You know, the smell of the seats, we'd go to concourse competitions. So he would do them up and you would enter into a competition and they'd be judged these cars about what's the best car. If you have the old Aston Martins, they can be millions now, you know, DB4 GT or something like that. And it was £4 million. So it's stupid money. It's that Romani Conti of cars. So I spent a lot of my time at racetracks and these car events, and they were all Aston Martin ones. So it was very much, I've got an Aston Martin finally, I've kind of achieved something, Dad. And, you know, it was nice, but I only had it for a year and a half because I moved house. And, you know, I don't think driving those cars in London is particularly good look a lot of the time. You know, they make you a target. And I got rid of it, I sold it, and I bought a Citroen DS21 that goes up on hydraulics. And the Aston went 0-60 in something like 6 seconds, and the Citroen did the same thing in about 21 seconds. And I vividly remember having just bought it, being on Shepherd's Bush roundabout, and the lights turned from red to green, and the bus did me off the lights. And it was this, I thought, what have I done?
You're at Island Records from 2006 to 2009. And then you found the Noble Rot magazine late 12 into 2013. And what's happening in between that period of time? You got a little cash in your pocket.
So left Island, then did a label called Hideout. We signed a couple of acts that didn't happen. At the time, I was also wanting to find out more about wine and enrolled at WSET. Was going to Robeson Wine still quite a lot, which was next door to Island Records, where I met Mark, my business partner. And I taught myself how to cook a bit more, or, you know, and just trying to work out what to do next. I mean, it's coming up to being late 30s, so, you know, you've got another roll of the dice, or maybe two, because people have like different careers. But I knew I didn't want to stay in major record labels. So I started thinking, you know, could I be a chef? And I didn't want to be a chef because I was probably too old for that. And it's a very demanding job. And I love cooking at home, but that's a very different thing. So I didn't want to start a restaurant, and I was, you know, more obsessed by wine. So I didn't want to become a sommelier. Again, it's a very demanding job. So I kind of bought some time when Mark and I started the magazine, and I thought that the best strategy might be just to, well, to start writing again, because when you write, you meet people and doors open that you never knew were even there, and one thing leads to another and opportunities. So really when we started drinking together and then realized quite early on that we've got a very similar taste in wine and a very dark sense of humor that's quite similar. So we kind of hatched this plan after these tastings that Mark would be doing at Robeson's, and the early seeds of Noble Rot were kind of there. I think I did some tastings as well for friends at my house, and I would have them round, and, you know, we later did a pop-up, a Noble Rot pop-up after the magazine had started. But it was a very touch-and-go time. Changing career is a leap of faith. It's a tough thing. And when you get your first paycheck on the other side in another completely different area, it means a lot more, even if it's a lot less money. You know, you start some things and you might not make money from them. You know, a lot of things start like that, but you do them because you really want to do them and they have meaning for you. And if you can then monetize them, I mean, a key part of it, obviously, is to say that you have to think that there, you can monetize something in the future, but it might not be that that's the time you're monetizing it. And I think with Noble Rot, it was always about building something that was inclusive, that people wanted to be part of, that was doing something different to what was around. And having the opportunity to spend, you know, the first couple of years trying to find our feet, trying to get a community of writers and illustrators together, it was the foundations of to what was to come later. Because once we got that small audience at the start, then we looked for investment so we could do a restaurant. And then once we did the first restaurant, it kind of built from there.
So you met Mark Andrew, a man with two first names. I always like to mention when someone has two first names.
First of all, I met him on the shop, the Robeson shop, and I'd go in there on a Tuesday afternoon, and he'd be working in there on a counter, and we'd talk about Freddie Mounier or, you know, Nuit Saint-Georges, Claude de Maréchal, for example, or we would talk about some of the kind of natural wines which were just kind of, they were starting to stock. So it was a very diverse range, and Mark is very passionate. You know, we had an equal thirst, if you like, for wanting to discover wine, and we have a very similar sense of humor and reference points, you know, with football and music and other things. So it felt very natural to start hanging out, and he would put on these amazing tastings. So it'd be Coche Durie Vertical, or it would be a Chave Hermitage Vertical, or Reyes. And this was a time when these wines, although they were expensive, they were still doable. You know, you could still save up and between three of you buy a bottle of Coche and, you know, have a magical experience. And we always talk about maybe one of the most seminal tastings he did was Grange de Pere. definitely seminal for me because it was 2010 and I was into wine, but I just remember tasting all these different vintages. And what I loved was some were just, you know, mind-blowingly good and some were just a bit dilute and they weren't homogenized. You know, they were what they were. And I think that that's kind of what we love about wine and the kind of wines that we want to work with. So we started drinking together after work. We'd go to a pub in Notting Hill called the Mall Tavern. We would take a bottle of Pinan 03 or we would take a Robineau wine or something like that. And we were exploring wine more together. I'm not sure who mentioned it first, but we soon found out that we'd both read the Kermit's book, Adventures on the Wine Route, and it had been a kind of seminal book. I mean, what I loved about it is I like Kermit's sense of humour. He's got a real charisma. He's not talking about it in just an academic way. He's talking about it from a lifestyle point of view and also a gastronomic point of view as well. And it really took you to the places and these wines, which are very much themselves. They're not trying to be other things. They weren't chasing after Parker points. They were kind of the antithesis of the kind of corporate side or the commercial side of wine. And that, to me, was more like alternative record labels like Rough Trade in Music rather than, you know, Polydor doing like S Club 7 or whatever. There's so many similarities. And that appealed to Mark too.
Once again, you decided to have a partner, which I think is a choice. It's obviously worked out very well for you, but I think it's a choice.
I think we do very different things and we have very different approaches to different things, but they can be complementary. And I think if I was trying to do what we do now on my own, I wouldn't be able to do it. And I think the same for him. It really does come down to a vibe, doesn't it? And you sit across from someone and you think, can I spend time with this person? It's like with your wife or your, you know, you can't pick the rest of your family, of course, but it's about wanting to spend time and ease and your personalities clicking together. My personality is very different to him. His. There's things that I do that I know that he probably looks at me and thinks, you know, you maybe you shouldn't be doing that. But this is kind of certainly stuff that I learned in music. I remember Osman Erhalp, who was the MD of A&M Records, you know, he taught me a lot. And one of the things that he taught me about A&R was you need to know about every band in the country that's unsigned. Ring the manager if he or she says it's going to send you a demo tape. It doesn't come 2 days later, call them again. If it doesn't come 2 days later, call them, call them, call them. So tenacity, whereas I think not everybody would do that. And I think that, you know, my tenacity sometimes is something that Mark wouldn't naturally do. So having the kind of two different but complementary mentalities, because there's things that Mark would do that I wouldn't do. We come from different upbringings and different places and we're different people. But it's difficult to quantify what that chemistry is. And I think it's the same with bands, isn't it? Some bands stay together, some bands split up, you know. Watching the Clash documentary I remember Joe Strummer saying is whatever you do, you know, that chemistry, whatever it is important. It's important to maintain it because as soon as you change it, and I think they fired their drummer, it's just never the same. So whatever our chemistry is, it works. I mean, we've been together 10 years on the magazine, which, you know, the Beatles were together 7 years. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we're anything like the Beatles, but a lot of bands, a lot of partnerships split up and there's something there. And I think a lot of it comes down to if you can laugh together when you have those hard moments, then that counts for quite a lot. You know, when we started out, we would know what each other likes to drink because we like to drink the same thing. So then, you know, that bit is fairly easy, and then having the contacts to find those kind of Ravenaux or Grange de Pears, or, you know, that's kind of the easy bit. But what Mark's very good at then is finding them, but then trying to find interesting wines that don't cost a lot of money, which are kind of real value picks on the list. Mark's responsibility really is buying and to put the list together. What he's really good at as well is he's a real people person and he really cares about the people that work for us. You know, he's in every appraisal with staff members. He's often fronting up the training side of what we do as well.
Before the restaurants happened, you guys did the magazine. So yeah. 2012, and then first issue was 2013. And maybe just walk me through what that was like.
Yeah, our first issue, we did 1,000 copies, hand-numbered, cost £500. You know, it was not even really going to have many illustrations in it until we got to sending off to the printers and realized we were being a bit mental, and then kind of had to work out, how do we get some illustrators? Where do we get them from? It was really this thing of starting before you're ready, which is kind of one of our kind of things that we've done. You know, we started a restaurant before we really knew what we were doing, started a magazine before we really knew what we're doing. But you find people who have more experience than you, and you get them as part of your team. So it was through connections that we kind of pulled stuff together, but it was more like a pamphlet than it was a magazine. And I'm proud of it being more of a fanzine than it is a magazine. Fanzine kind of says something about the kind of aesthetic we wanted to have, definitely not glossy. And, you know, everything from the stock, the paper stock, to the kind of illustrations, to the color scheme, everything needed to be refined. And it took a few issues to get to a place where I was happy with it. In the first few issues, Mark was doing like some very simple layouts on his computer, which is so dated, and like, but it got us going, and it got us to where it needed to be for the first bit, which was really about having a different voice and having a voice that appealed to us rather than, you know, we're fans of Jancis Robinson, we're fans of, you know, Hugh Johnson and Steven Spurrier, and these are people that we look up to, but they were generations above us. And, you know, certainly with Hugh and Steven Spurrier, they came from very upper class backgrounds. And if they didn't make a living with what they were doing, they would probably be all right. We were coming from a different generation, but I think that our timing was good, because the last 10 years has been the most exciting time in wine in many ways. All the different areas that have come back online from, you know, their vineyards being abandoned. It couldn't have been a better time to do a wine magazine.
I feel like by issue 7, it was kind of the noble rot that it is today. That's the one that has the Brian Eno and...
Yeah. Issue 7 was great. I mean, Eno is a hero, and he didn't let us down at all meeting him. You know, that thing about don't meet your heroes. Well, if Brian Eno's your hero, then you should meet him, because he's amazing. Again, another surprising thing, the fact that he said he collected smells and he went and got all these little vials. And then he told us that he'd put together a perfume that he'd given to an artist that he'd worked with. And she'd said that she'd got her husband by wearing it. And he said that you can't wear it in the street because it was too powerful and attractant for the opposite sex. So, you know, he's just an incredibly engaging individual. He's like the kind of art teacher that you never had, like the best art teacher you would have had at school. So that was really good. Being able to join these dots between music people or art people and wine and food, and contextualize it in a way that made sense to us, and we knew it would, or we hoped would, make sense to other people too.
You in that issue had done the Dujac piece, which became, I think, kind of seminal for you in opening some doors in Burgundy.
Jeremy got in touch, Jeremy Says from Dujac, and he'd got the magazine, and we'd exchanged some emails, and then he very generously said, do you want to come to Dujac? And the answer, of course, is yes. He'd got a couple of pigs, and every year he kills one of his pigs and, you know, makes charcuterie and, you know, pork chops and whatever else. So I went for that, and it was an amazing trip, and Jeremy's very generous, and that domain has got such a great history, such soulful wines. And it was an experience that I'll never forget. And through Jeremy, we met Jean-Marc Rouleau, who we later went on to start working with importing his wines into the UK. So it was a very important trip.
That's a direct correlation between how the writing and the magazine ended up being an import business as well.
Yeah. And I think if you're making wine and you see people talking about it in a way that kind of connects with how you feel about it, then you're going to feel good about that. Whereas other magazines might not do that. They might do it in a more commercial, points-driven, trying to describe a wine by breaking it down into descriptors kind of way, which is something that we've never done. And so I think that would appeal to them.
There have been some people who sold wine who wrote really well about wine.
Yeah.
Kermit Lynch would be one of them. Terry Theis would be another example. You know, wrote in inspiring ways, reached different kinds of audiences through their kinds of writing, but ultimately they also sold wine.
Yeah.
And you are this person now. I think originally you were not. You were a guy who had a magazine, right? And so did that feel different when you also started representing the same wines that you were writing about, or no?
No, not really. I mean, with Noble Rot, we're not saying that we're impartial. We're saying that we love these wines. We really love these winemakers. We're not impartial. We can sell you the wine as well. That was part of what I really used to love about Kermit's writing. There's a book he did called Inspiring Thirst, which is the catalogues from the 70s and the 80s. And he'll be writing about Henri Jaillet, and he'll say, I've got these Echezoes in at the moment, and he'll tell a little story about it. And I've got like two cases, and you think, fuck, I really want to buy it. But obviously, this is like 30 or 40 years in the past. You don't have to be impartial. What we would say is we stand by everything that we sell, and we would drink it ourselves. And I don't think everybody in wine is like that. They're selling it as a commodity. Of course, it is a commodity for us, but we're selling it because we love these wines. There's nobody in our portfolio who we don't really rate. So yeah, I think it's kind of probably the Kermit Lynch model that we followed there.
What hasn't worked and what does work when you're writing about wine?
Ultimately, the reader should come away with a takeaway or two or three takeaways about something they didn't know before. You know, I want people to go away and think, oh, you know, I didn't know that about Muscadet. I'll try that. That's really important. And also to keep, yeah, you can veer off subject a bit, but you've got to have a story arc, and you've got to start off with something that's engaging. I like to put a bit of humor in there too, just to kind of, because people have a short attention span. So the main thing is having takeaways, and takeaways are probably insights. And insight comes from processing information, not just kind of regurgitating information that winemakers have told you or chefs have told you, but to then go back to the thing of, why should I care? Why should anyone care? What's special about this? And to try and convey that. And I think when you overthink things, when you set out to try and be too funny or overwrite, that's a trap that you fall into a lot, especially when you first start writing. Simplicity of sentences, you know, it just comes from doing it a lot. And you just have to, just like anything, just repeat, screw up, be prepared to screw up. You know, sometimes write a piece, think, nah, doesn't work, come at it from another angle, and not beat yourself up about it either. Not to think, oh, I'm a crap writer. It just means that this one piece hasn't worked. But it means a lot of work, and it means being obsessed with doing that work. So, I mean, I used to think that you had to sit at a desk and, you know, have no distractions and only way that you could write. But now I could be on the tube and I'm doing like 20 minutes of writing in a crowded tube, and I just am able to hone in much more on getting on with work.
What about that topic of obsession? It's come up a few times. I feel like it's an attribute you look for. What do you think appeals to you about that?
So there has to be, you know, people who tend to do well are pretty much obsessed with what they do. Writers are, you know, novelists. Irvine Welsh talked about, you know, I'm not a very nice person to live with, because I'm always up in my room, and, you know, my girlfriend or my wife would have people round, and they're like, well, why don't you come downstairs instead of being upstairs with your imaginary friends? But that's an obsession, but that's what's made him an amazing writer. You know, going back to Chris Martin, one of the most impressive things about working with him was his obsession. You know, we spent a lot of time together the first three albums, but we didn't talk about superficial stuff most of the time. It was just talking about songs, his songs, and recording, and it was an obsession. I can see that.
How do you think you've developed as a writer? Because you're not just a magazine owner, you're also a writer for this magazine. How do you think you've changed?
To develop as a writer, you need to read other writers. You need to look at how they structure things. There's people that write for the magazine, like Marina O'Loughlin. You know, she's been good to bounce ideas off. You know, if I've written something, I can get feedback as a writer from someone who I really respect as a writer. And her restaurant criticism and A.A. Gill and there was Giles Corran and they were all English kind of restaurant reviewers, but they all were quite funny. When they're on form, they write in a funny, entertaining way because their role is not just to give an objective kind of criticism of a restaurant, it's to be entertaining to readers. And so I've always kind of tried to take some of that and do that in wine, which I didn't think was done very much. So I feel that I'm improving as a writer. And, you know, when you start out, you think, oh, I've got to do a wine grower's biography and they did this and they did that. And I'm less interested in doing that, far less interested in doing that now. I'm more interested in trying to find insights into why things matter and to try and express the feeling of what going somewhere feels like or what drinking something feels like and why anyone else should care about it. You know, I want to make people laugh. A lot of writers don't, but a lot of writers do, and I feel that that is something I really want to achieve. So coming at something with a little bit of a quirky kind of angle, like you're trying to talk to a friend and you're trying to, you know, make your friend laugh. Sometimes you imagine that. And I think that about restaurants too. I was in Noble Rot the other day and was having lunch with a friend and I just kind of turned around and had a kind of moment of clarity where there was just a lot of laughter. And it was like a Monday lunchtime or something. And it was just people enjoying themselves. And it's a great restaurant is a bubble that people escape from their lives in. And that's something really positive that it offers the world. And I think that writing and restaurants are similar in that way. So, yeah, but laughter, that's the key to it.
Have you had any kind of dark nights of the soul or kind of crisis moments where you wondered about the level of irreverence when the world is kind of in turmoil? Is it even still possible to be as glib or as easily funny as it would have been a decade ago?
I think you've got to tread carefully in certain circumstances. I had a cover for one of the issues during lockdown, the If Not Now, When cover, which came out as Old Father Time with a clock round his neck on a chain holding a bottle of Latache. That originally was the Grim Reaper. And at a time when obviously people were dying of COVID, it would have been inappropriate to put it out. I mean, it's a good cover, but yeah, I mean, it's a fine line to walk. I mean, just before COVID, we had an idea for an article and it was with Stephen Harris, our exec chef, and Jack Keenan, who's one of our shareholders who died. He'd been ill, but he was, you know, he's 86, Jack, and he was one of the youngest spirited older people that I've ever met in my life and a real wine lover with an amazing cellar. He gave us two bottles of Russo Chambertin, and the article was going to be Stephen cooking with the Chambertin, a coq au vin, and then cooking with like a supermarket Pinot Noir, and then we'd have a little panel of tasters and we would just see. I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of outlandish, but it was a serious question, which is how much does quality of wine as an ingredient affect the finished result? Obviously, we had that planned and then COVID happened, and then it would be completely inappropriate to be cooking a £3,000 bottle of wine into a coq au vin. Now, we would love to do it, but, you know, the time has gone. That's being irreverent about wine. So, yes, it's a time of, we kind of seem to lurch from one apocalypse to another at the moment. But also, you have to be able to have a laugh about life, because if, as the saying goes, if you can't laugh about it, then what else do you have? So I don't think it's harder to be irreverent or glib. You just got to be appropriate to whatever the circumstances. You know, spend a lot of time thinking about covers. If you haven't got the right cover, then I'd rather delay a copy of the issue of the magazine than put one out that's not right. And the best covers often come from an idea, a kind of slogan or whatever. Like we did one, Make Wine, Not War, with Trump and Kim Jong-il on the cover, which really connected with people. And, you know, coming up with those kind of phrases and taglines, Shrine to the Vine, Winos of Attitude, Sex and Drugs and Pinot Noir, some of them are better than others, but they're all trying to convey this kind of sense of humour and attitude that we're trying to set ourselves apart from other brands with.
I mean, I think several times you've avoided the trap of not doing it with style. So let me give you some examples. I think a lot of people, when faced with a magazine that didn't make any money, would say, well, we need to release this magazine more often and we need to take a lot more advertising. And you did neither.
Yeah.
Okay. So most people would have done that. And then most people, after they started their successful restaurant, they would get an offer from a hotel group or a developer to go open up in some glass box for their second restaurant, some glass box with no soul.
Yeah.
In an area of industrial development with no character. And you've decided not to do that either. Most people do that. Or most people would say, well, yeah, we have all the style points already, but what we really need is to import a wine that is made at such quantity that we can really make some money.
Mm.
We can talk about all the great artisans, but actually what we really do that floats the bottom line is we bring in pallets and containers of this other wine that sells to supermarkets. And I feel like all three of these things you've declined to do. It's more about what you've said no to than what you've said yes to. Does this make sense?
Yeah, totally. And that, in a nutshell, is it. It's what you say no to. It's a business with, you know, 120 people at Noble Rock, but it's also a passion. And as soon as we start making compromises on that, then I think it's very easy to lose your way. You know, one compromise leads to another. The art's not quite so good. You know, maybe that'll happen one day. Like, everything has a shelf life, but we're still as curious and driven as we were at the start to push Noble Rot on and to find out about new wine areas, to find out what is Valais wine like, to go to different places and to give people a good experience as a hospitality business.
You guys keep yourself so busy, it's almost sort of uncanny how you've decided to open restaurants during a pandemic or go on a book tour during a pandemic. And you're like the Energizer Bunny. You just want to keep moving.
I mean, you've got to be out there. I mean, it's what we love as well. I mean, we love restaurants. We love wine. We love talking to people about both those things. Love visiting winemakers. Love creating stuff as well. So to have the opportunity to continue doing that, if you rest on your laurels, then you need momentum of a project. I've seen that in music and most successful artists. They don't take too much time off because it's about keeping your momentum. And maybe there's something deep in your psyche that this isn't a given, that you're always going to have an audience, that your restaurants are always going to be busy, that, you know, you're going to come up with new ideas that connect with people. But you have to just keep peddling and, you know, keep doing what you're doing for the right reasons. And the right reasons are that it makes you happy what you do and you can make a living.
I've heard you reference that a few times where you've said, well, we have the success now, but we don't know. And I just wonder, is that a real thought that you have? Like, do you actually...
I would never take anything for granted because I've changed career and I've gone from being very successful in something to not so successful and then changed out of it. You cannot take anything for granted at all. I mean, it's life, isn't it? And we're here, but for the grace of God, being complacent, your business can easily fall apart, and especially in the current climate. I mean, I think we're at a bit of a seismic change in some ways about in restaurants. You know, I've been to a few kind of high-end restaurants recently, especially, you know, those with a couple of Michelin stars or 3 stars or whatever, with a lot of chefs, and, you know, interest rates are high. People are going out maybe a little bit less. I mean, maybe I'm talking about outside London than I am inside London and New York, as we will definitely have their own little ecosystems. But I think we're a bit of a crossroads at the moment. It's a very challenging time. So to do what you're doing to the best of your ability as a business owner, this is what you need to do, because there's going to be a lot of casualties. If the British government hadn't given out COVID loans, then we wouldn't be here today. You know, most likely most restaurants wouldn't be.
One choice you've made that's also distinctive is that you and Mark are the face of the restaurant group. And in that era of the chef-driven restaurant, this is unusual because neither of you are a chef. And
no,
it's kind of in the Danny Meyer model, who is also not a chef, but it's increasingly uncommon that the wine guy or front of the house would be the people doing the interviews, people receiving awards, people really associated as the face of the restaurant.
I think you're right. I think over the last however many years, it was driven by chefs. And I enjoy being a restaurateur, so does Mark, but it's unusual. But I think one of the things that we have that maybe other restaurants don't have is a USP, which is very clear, which is we are here to celebrate wine culture, and we will find amazing value wines for as little money as we can. And we'll find old stocks of, you know, Rhones or Bordeaux or whatever at good value. So our ambition, we always wanted to be the wine people in London, that if you came from America to London, you would know about Noble Rot and you would make a beeline for it. And that's still our ambition. So yeah, it's Noble Rot's a bit different like that. But that comes from being a magazine first. I mean, I don't know any other restaurant group that came from a magazine. It's just an obscure way to come into the industry.
Do you feel that people want to work with you as employees because there is a clear mission statement?
Undoubtedly, yeah. I think having a clear mission statement, you can come and work at Noble Rot and you will learn about wine. You'll be exposed to great wine. You'll meet other people who are just as into it as you are. And I think that that gives us a great advantage over some other restaurants. But yeah, you need a mission statement. You also need to know what you're not, what the enemy is. And for us, kind of commercial, bland wine is a kind of enemy.
A.A. Gill was somebody that you've alluded to as being an influence in terms of writing. You liked his reviews and you liked his writing style, and it kind of influenced how you went in your own writing. And then he reviewed your first restaurant before he died. What was that like being reviewed by him?
That was the most nerve-wracking of all the reviews. And I remember he wrote for the Sunday Times. So it got to Saturday night and he'd been in a few weeks before, and it got to like 11:57, and it was just about to flip from Saturday Times to the Sunday Times, and I kept refreshing the page, and then it was another restaurant. And then the next week I did the same thing, and the next week, and I think on the fourth week after there was a bit of a delay, it was us. I think it was 4 stars out of 5. So obviously I looked at the stars first of all and I thought, fuck, at least he hasn't given us a mauling. That's quite good. He was the kind of reviewer that if he didn't like something, he could write you a 1 out of 5 and just give you a mauling. And it was just before the Brexit vote, and he used our breadboard as a kind of a metaphor for why Britain should stay in the European Union. And I don't think I or Mark, my business partner, or anyone else really that we worked with thought that we would be voted out of the European Union. So it was just before a very dark time. And we woke up that morning and it felt like we'd been kicked in the nuts, and it was like someone had died.
When we come back, it's a Rotter's road trip to Burgundy, a survey of some of the world's wine regions, and a look at where different wines fit into the market today.
I think during lockdown, what happened with Burgundy prices, no one could have foreseen. And I think it really has changed things there. You know, the top wines, they were, you know, if they were £500 before lockdown, some of them, as you know, they could be £3,000 for the Grand Crus.
That's after this. I've been lucky enough to try some amazing wines while traveling over the years. Unfortunately, I've found that some of those same wines are really hard to find here in the United States. Whenever I run into trouble finding a favorite bottle, I go to idealwine.com and they have what I'm looking for, whether it is a hard-to-source bottle of Burgundy or a micro-production natural wine like I Need the Sun by Domaine de Miroir. I know there's a chance that Ideal Wine might have it available. And Ideal Wine's entire Paris inventory is available to American customers with just a click. The process is seamless, the site is easy to use, and orders are shipped directly to you. Head over to idealwine.com, that's IDEALWINE.com, to see for yourself what you could be drinking. These days you spend 5-6 trips a year to Burgundy, right?
I'd say we go like 4 or 5, yeah.
It's been over a decade of, you know, having experiences there, and it's changed a lot.
I think during lockdown, what happened with Burgundy prices, no one could have foreseen. And I think it really has changed things there. You know, the top wines, They were, you know, if they were £500 before lockdown, some of them, as you know, they could be £3,000 for the Grand Cruise. But I do think some of those prices are leveling off and coming down now. I think there was a lot of people who had a lot of money in the bank, a lot of spare time, just getting into Burgundy and were prepared to spend it. But now they've filled their cellars, and I think that they probably want to dispose of some of these wines because they might have got it because they were just speculating maybe. So I think there's a bit of a realignment coming with some of the top domains. But I think what's key about Burgundy and keeping it vital is the new generation that are in the kind of outlier appellations like Morange or up in the Oak Coat, and people being able to set up their own domains. And Cassiopeia, for example, is a very good example of that. A couple, Hugo and Tallulah, who worked for Jean-Marc, also worked for Freddie Mounier, and have gone to Morange, a place that previously would just be for bulk wine, that would be too cold to ripen a lot of the time, and are making beautiful wines that are accessible. So for Burgundy to continue in a really meaningful way, people who are just getting into wine need to be able to drink the wines. And Sylvain Patay, for example, another good example, Jean-Marc Vincent. Accessible Burgundy is key because some of these Grand Crus have gone so astronomical that only the very rich will be able to drink them. But I think that's a concern for everybody, and I think the growers know it. I mean, it's got to be, if you're making something which is beautiful and, you know, a masterwork in a great year, or even, you know, it doesn't have to be a warm year, it could be a kind of more classic year like 21, and you've made this really profound wine. If your wine's just disappeared into some kind of speculators' cellars and may never get drunk, it's kind of a bit depressing, isn't it? So I think we'll see over the next few years. It'd be fascinating to follow what happens with Burgundy, but I've got, you know, real optimism that it will level out. Maybe some of the kind of prices will come down at the top end, and, you know, you've got this new generation coming through that still makes it the best place to visit if you're into wine. I mean, nowhere makes wine like Burgundy. It's kind of, at its best, it's kind of unbeatable.
The Rotter's Road Trip is a section of your book where you talk about different travels, different tasting experiences, different visits to cellars. In the Burgundy context, are there certain ones that have really stood out for you, visits to cellars?
People that we started working with when we started working with them have stood out. I remember going to see Sebastian Caillat at La Micaia in Chassin-Montrachet and tasting with him. Mark and I went there and we came out of this tasting, and Sebastian's a very self-effacing, mellow guy who makes incredible wines. And we came out of there and we both looked at each other and just was like, fuck, that's like one of the best tastings we've ever had. You know, the wines had real richness to them and weight, but they were also really precise and linear. So it's a magical kind of thing to pull off in white Burgundy. That was amazing. You know, tasting with Freddie Mounier, and, you know, Freddie's wines are probably the Burgundies that really got me into Burgundy. And so going there and tasting with him is always a treat. And there's just something about his Chambolles are just incredible. I mean, going on, there's people like Minoret Jouberg, who we're starting to work with as an importer. Tasting their 21s was fantastic. And there's so many good producers. You could just go on and on. And I think that with the people that are switched on, the switched on winemakers that travel and drink from other regions, not just Burgundy, I think the winemaking is getting better and better. Obviously, we've got the climate getting warmer, so that has its own problems. But yeah, I'm always really excited.
At one point, you used to kind of describe yourself as an outsider in the wine world. But, you know, when you're the importer of Rouleau and Minoret Jouberg, I feel like you kind of made it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more of a mindset. I don't know if your American listeners will know Jose Mourinho. He's a football coach, yeah. I always used to love how he set himself up as an outsider and the team up. I think it's a good place to be. When I was in music, I didn't necessarily feel like, I was an insider in music, and I don't necessarily feel like I'm a insider in wine. It's more of a mindset type thing. I mean, you don't want to just become part of the establishment, even though we probably are established. And yeah, I mean, there's nothing like the vastness of wine to make you feel like you don't know anything about it at all. Like, okay, I was in Valais the other day and we went to this restaurant that's famous for raclette, and I got the wine list and it was like 30 pages of wines that I have no idea what like 99% of them are. I knew Chappaz, I knew maybe five or six other names, but because there was probably a lot of kind of commercial wine on there as well, but it was all Swiss wines. And Swiss wines, as we know, they don't get exported, so we never see them. So no matter how much you think you know about wine, you go there or go somewhere else and you realise you just know a bit about wine. So, yeah, it's quite easy to reconnect with that feeling of knowing fuck all.
I feel like you're often, the audience is not actually like wine dorks. I feel like you're trying to appeal to normal people and having that outsider view. Yeah, we're also outsiders in this world of wine, although we have some great experiences, I think would seem more appealing to normal people who are like, I don't know about the wine world.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I think there's so many barriers in wine. I think the barriers have become less. I think natural wine, you know, you can argue about the rights and the wrongs about it, but what it has done is it's made wine accessible to a lot more people because they don't need to know necessarily what even a grape is or an appellation. They can just, you know, it's a funky wine with a colorful label. So I think some of the barriers have changed, but I've never really liked, like, I remember going into Berry Brothers years ago to the wine shop and, you know, I didn't know that Le Menil was called Le Menil. I thought it was Le Mesnil. So you'd say that and you'd kind of get corrected snootily about it. So wine knowledge is easy to hit people over the head with. You know, there's a lot of that still, a lot of making people feel small. And that's not really what we're about. We're about, we want the magazine to be entertaining. We want it to be fun. We want the restaurants to be inclusive. We want to make people feel special. And at the end of the day, we want to make people laugh as well, which is something that's missing from a lot of wine media or food media. So it's about injecting a sense of fun to what we do. And we don't want to be too academic. We want to come from the point of view of being drinkers as well.
One of the things I've learned is you really learn who somebody is when you go on a wine trip with them. You really find out who this person is that's with you. And one of the early trips you took with Mark was to the Jura. What was that experience like?
Well, there's only a couple of times we shared a bedroom, and that was one of them. And I found out that he had some different showering habits. So he likes a very long shower. But then we stayed together in one of the worst hotels I've ever been in Paris, called the Absolute Hotel, and with these two beds which were literally just falling apart, and I think that fucked both of our backs up. But yeah, so it was quite close proximity, our first wine trips. You know, we're in these twin rooms. But I think, you know, on a wine trip, you're driving a lot, you're between appointments, you're meeting people for the first time, you're having to take on an incredible amount of information about a lot of different cuvées a lot of the time, process that. So you're cramming in all these amazing visits, and then you're getting out for the evening and you're going to, you know, simple restaurants but with good wine lists. And when you're in France, as you know, it's the best place to drink Burgundy or Rhones or whatever at good prices, because restaurants will get them on allocation from the producers and they won't be able to do silly markups because the producers won't give them any more. So we had some incredible experiences when we first started out. Jean-Paul Jeunet was a two-star restaurant in Arbois that we went to on that trip where we shared the bedroom. And I remember we drank a Massini off the list for 300 euros from Freddie Mounier in 07, which again, one of those seminal moments for us. At the time, it had really old vintages of Jacques Pouffenet, you know, 96, the Côte de Jura for probably 70 euros or whatever. But as we've seen in the 10 years, some of these wines have become almost unattainable. That Massini today would be £2,500. And that's not because of what Freddie Mounier is doing, it's just because of what the market's doing. And it's a challenge of the wine industry or wine culture is that not everyone can taste these wines anymore.
And that Jura trip is probably when Mark had that visit to Tissot that seemed to really hit him, got him going.
If we're talking about visits or great visits in the Jura, I'd say Stéphane Tissot is probably one of the most brilliant ambassadors for that region or any region. We did a masterclass with Van Jone with him the last time we saw him, and he took the whole morning out and, you know, poured his full range over multiple different vintages and talked about Vanjone, because he's one of the only people, I think, who do different single vineyard Vanjones, which is something that I love. I mean, I think it's one of those wines that is just unique. It's like, I love Condrieu as well, which couldn't be more different to Vanjone, but I love it because it is itself. Or I like White Hermitage because, I mean, a lot of people don't like those white Rhone wines because they're rich, they go against the zeitgeist for kind of svelte high acid wines. So yeah, anyone who can go and see Stéphane Tissot as a visit should do so, because he's a passionate vigneron who is just about opening people's eyes to this wonderful wine that he makes, or different wines that he makes.
So some other places you've been, you know, you traveled to Rioja, for example, and you're pretty familiar with those wines as well.
Yeah. Lopez de Heredia was amazing. Telmo Rodriguez as well, great winemaker. I mean, going into Lopez de Heredia and going down to the basement, they've got a room at the bottom where they've got vintages stretching back to like 1850 or something. And it's got so many cobwebs and spiders and mold growing all over that place. That was a really influential place to go. And it's the same story as other parts of Spain, that people are finding lost vineyards. Telmo Rodriguez took over Las Pietas vineyards, which he said were the old Grand Crus, trying to resurrect history from like 200-300 years ago, beyond even the kind of Lopez de Heredia history. So fascinating time in Spain. Love going to Spain. You know, Spain is, I think, the most exciting wine country of the last 10 years in terms of its development. I mean, Commando G, I was just writing about their entry-level wine. And of course, their rare single vineyard cuvées go for a lot of money now, but for less than £30, you can still buy their entry level that gives you a real taste of the magic. Suerte del Marquez in Tenerife, who we're working with as well, you know, the kind of smokiness of those wines, they taste like they're grown on volcanic rock, and they have an incredible kind of visceral kind of energy to them. You know, the new producers making unfortified sherry, like Willy Pérez and, you know, Cota 45, fantastic wines. So yeah, wherever you look in Spain, it seems to have reinvented itself from making oaky, turbocharged, high alcohol, headache juice into making these more finessed styles. And they've all been looking to Burgundy and places like that to see how to do that.
A region that impacted you, that you were pleasantly surprised by, that maybe was a learning experience for you, was Tuscany.
Yeah. When we went to see Soldera, unfortunately, he was in hospital and we'd arranged to see him. And he was obviously, he came out of hospital and a few weeks later he died. But that was a profound meeting with Monica, his daughter, to see the lengths that he went to, how uncompromising he was to make his wines. The fact that, you know, he wouldn't just get rid of like the big berries, he'd get rid of the really small ones, which other estates would never do, because as we know, that's where a lot of the flavor is. But he wanted a uniformity. And when you taste the wines, the sensuality of the wines and the generosity of the wines, the kind of ethereality of them, were just head and shoulders above so many others. You could see the relationship between what he was doing, his process, and the finished wine. So that was an amazing visit. A few months later, or maybe a couple of years later, we went to Chianti, and I knew a bit about Chianti, but it was maybe the commercial stuff and I was not particularly into it. But one thing I do love doing more and more is not knowing that much about a certain wine area and then just go, right, fuck it, we'll go there. And then doing your research as you go. Like recently, I've been in Valais in Switzerland. I didn't really know much about those wines because they're not exported very much. Savoie. So you go, you just talk to people, and you know, rather than going with a preconceived idea of what's the story is going and trying to talk to people, get their viewpoint, but then to let it percolate through your brain for a few weeks and seep into your subconscious and to retaste the wines and then think, well, what is the story of this place, or what is one particular facet of it? Because what we don't want to do is be an encyclopedic objective view on a certain area. It's to have a story that is going to be insightful to readers, that is, why does this place matter or not? But Chianti was, I think, one of the most impressive visits in terms of how cheap the wines currently are to how good the best producers are. Like Tenuta di Caglioni, you know, those wines, Uno, for I don't know how much it is now, maybe £60. It's an incredible wine. That's a wine, if you wanted something of that level in Burgundy, you'd be paying £500 for, you know, or maybe £300. But it's going somewhere and leaving your preconceptions behind can be such an amazing thing.
In a way, you did that with Bordeaux too, because, you know, it's so out of fashion now. And yeah, you went and you kind of did a deep dive, and not everyone would do that right now, honestly, in media.
No, I mean, Bordeaux, we sell a lot of in the restaurants, but we sell a lot of mature Bordeaux. It's incredible value that, you know, you can pick up some of the best wines in the region for comparatively not so much money when you compare it to Burgundy again. So there's value there. But I still really don't get where kind of en primeur is at with Bordeaux, because the prices are just as expensive as some of the old vintages. So, for example, in the piece, I think I quote Cos d'Estonel, you can buy 2001, a good but underrated vintage of Cos d'Estonel, for £200 less than you can buy the 2021 en primeur, which needs 20 or 30 years in the bottle and the cellar to be interesting, which I don't understand how that business model is even workable. That's got some recorrecting to do. But I loved going to Bordeaux. I loved, you know, I got to go to Cheval Blanc and Haut-Brion, two of my favorite chateaux. And then Le Carme Haut-Brion, which I write about at the end of the piece, this chateau that's using Cabernet Franc predominantly, using whole clusters, which is kind of unheard of in Bordeaux, certainly since Destemmers came in all that time ago, and coming up with these beautiful, ethereal, elegant wines that can be drunk fairly early in their life, like we've been selling the 2017 in the restaurants. I think it tastes absolutely amazing now, and I don't know many other really good estates there whose wines you can drink that early and get that kind of experience from.
One of the countries or bigger wine regions that you guys cover in your book that I think a lot of writers whose first language is English do not cover is Greece. And Mark seems particularly keyed up on Greek wine and Santorini wine in particular.
Mark is a master of wine, and he wrote his dissertation for the master of wine on Santorini Assyrtiko, did a lot of research about it. But he's a big Greekophile. I think he secretly must have been Greek in another life. And, you know, we work with some fantastic producers, Dalamara, Xenomavro we import from Nosa, which are fantastic, Ekonomu, whose wines are just idiosyncratic. You know, the last release, we had an Antigone, 2004, and he's aged the wine himself in all sorts of different vessels and has only just released it now, like 18 years later. I mean, those kind of wines, that's what we love. We love characters. And we love really individual wines that are of someone and of a place as well. Because as much as terroir matters and the expressing the place, the person matters, and their personality is often in the wine as well.
I see you guys doing that quite a bit. That's a continuing theme, looking for the characters. And the way I would sum it up is that during the Industrial Revolution, with all the trains coming through and the automobiles hitting the road and you know, coal factories happening, that's also in the arts. That's the flourishing of the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists. That's, you know, people going out of the countryside. They're painting water lilies, and, you know, behind them is a steaming locomotive in real life, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like what you guys do often is the reality of the wine world is that there's a lot of industrial plonk. That's just the reality percentage-wise of what the wine world is, that there's a lot of made in huge quantity junk that's designed for supermarkets.
Yeah.
And you guys are looking the other direction. You're looking for individual soulful characters and leaving the industrial part out of the frame.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, we're not against supermarket wine for the sake of being against supermarket wine. But definitely before knowing anything at all about wine, you know, when you watch those kind of TV personalities talk about a, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon from, you know, Australia, and they would get, you know, they describe how they've got kind of blackberries and they've got, you know, cigar smoke and they've got all these other things, and the descriptors got more and more outlandish. I would try some of the wines and I'd think it just smells of kind of wine. It just has a very generic, you know, there's no edges. There's zero personality, and I would be very disillusioned. And I think there's a lot of people who look at wine as quite pretentious nonsense because of that, because of this describing commercial, industrial wine as having a personality when it really doesn't. And the other side of that is, you know, are you a snob? You know, not everyone can spend £100 on a bottle of wine, or £20 or £15 or whatever your metric is. But it's not about that. It's, you know, I think about a lot of commercial wine is like ready meals, and it will sustain you. Yes, it has got chicken in it. Yes, it has got rice in it. But you buy some chicken and you cook the chicken and you have the rice and you cook that and you have a proper recipe. It doesn't have to be outlandish. It can be very simple, but it's going to taste of something. It's going to be comforting. It's going to be nourishing. It's not like some processed stuff that is just generic. And I think that that's our mission, in terms of part of the mission for Noble Rot, is to give people wines that are made by actual families and people in a place that is representative of something different, that it might not always be consistent. And I know that when you're a supermarket buyer, you have to have consistency. That's something that if you're scaling up, they need to have, and they also need to have it at the cheapest price. So then you've got the pressure on the farmer to, you know, cut corners with, you know, fertilizers and all that stuff. But yes, it does supply people with cheap wine, but it fucks the planet up and it's actually not that pleasurable. So maybe drinking something else would be better for you. So doing something different, you know, sticking to your guns. It's when you find these winemakers, Jean-Marie Guffins, for example, who I've met a few times and is always a bit of an inspiration. I mean, he's great from a journalistic point of view because he's always got so many great quotes and is not afraid to say something and take a pot shot at whoever else.
I mean, if he didn't do that, that would be a big surprise, actually. Yeah. He'd be like, what's going on, man? Are you feeling sick? You didn't take any pot shots today.
Exactly. But inspirational in that would go to an area known for the wine being made at the local co-op and no one really dreaming about anything else, and just made these wines that then would surpass lofty names from Pellini von Meschet in blind tastings. So, I mean, going back to being an underdog, I love that about Guffins. That's part of his story. I'm the underdog, and I've taken on people that are supposed to be much better than I am, and I've done something good. And maybe that ethos is ingrained a little bit in what we do as well, that we weren't part of the wine industry, and there's a part of the wine industry which is stuck very much in the past, and it was an opportunity that we could take to do something different.
That's the part where I actually see your work as more similar to someone like Robert Parker than maybe you would think of it as, because he was also a huge underdog guy. He was also a huge outsider to the wine trade guy. And he was also a huge fan of Guffins, who gave him huge scores and thought, you know, he was a hero incarnate, and loved the fact that he was a guy who wasn't part of the yes man factory. And I loved that he was an individualist. And looking over the broad sweep of things, for me, what I see in media is that the theme of being an outsider in the wine world comes up again and again, but is often reinvented to the age. And I think you're the current manifestation of it. It's kind of like Doctor Who a little bit.
When Robert Parker, you know, who was revolutionary at that time, came out, he was standing up for the consumer, as he said, and he was saying that he's completely impartial, which I don't know if I 100% agree with. Anyone can be 100% impartial. Maybe he was when he started out, but he was definitely put himself up as the outsider, and he changed a lot. He made it so much more accessible, wine. So I've got a lot of respect for Parker. What I don't have so much time for is that homogenization of taste, and people would then make wine to fit his palate, and that would be to the loss of expressing something individual about the place. But yes, I do agree that there are some similarities there. Although, you know, he was like so influential, and to have one person who is influential in wine or music or film, I think it's kind of unthinkable now.
You're a father, and you're someone who has kind of gone against the conventional wisdom a couple times to some success, right? And you, I think, are drawn to people who are like that. You like to profile people like that. You like to hang out with people like that.
Yeah.
But when it comes to giving advice to younger people who are entering this world about how they might conduct their own business, life, work, what would you tell them as important from a paternalistic viewpoint, not just the viewpoint of you know these people, but you really care about these people?
Yeah.
What are you going to tell them?
I would say to try and find something that you really enjoy doing, that you can find meaning and purpose with, that gets you out of bed in the morning, and to just get involved with it. I mean, you can start off, and it can be hard because you might not earn money from it at first, but you start with something small, and you do small steps, and one thing leads to another. I mean, with writing, as I've said, one thing leads to another, and you've got to get out there and kind of start before you're ready with some projects, and put yourself in a position where you can meet other people. So, you know, this generation coming through, it's going to be tough. I mean, it always is tough, but as we know, there's a lot of changes that are going to happen with technology. So you've got to be kind of clever about what the jobs will be in the future, what skills as a human being can you offer to others. But yeah, try and find something that really gives meaning to your life. And I've managed to do that with Noble Rot, and you know, it's writing about wine, which to some people could sound frivolous. And I sometimes think, well, it's wine, but this, you know, wine's such a deep subject. So it keeps me engaged. And, you know, I keep coming back to this kind of mission statement for Noble Rot, which is to entertain other people and to make them feel special. And that's worthwhile in itself. And if, you know, my kids, they might want to be doing something more creative, something more art-based. And if that's what you find meaning in, you should do it, and you should just get out there and get involved.
Dan Keeling has found a meaning for his own life by searching after the meaning of wine. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Livy.
Dan Keeling, the co-founder, co-owner of Noble Rot Magazine, the Noble Rot restaurants in London, England, Keeling, Andrew & Co., as well as Shrine to the Vine, the retail shop in London. All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's I-L-L, drinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening. I listened to several interviews with Dan Keeling while preparing questions for our own conversation, and a couple that stood out for me were episode 27 of the Mag Culture podcast and a Book Larder YouTube episode with Dan and Mark. Check those out if you'd like to hear more.
So with the Blue Room EP, we started off with a guy called Chris Allison, and Chris Allison had worked with the Beta Band, and the Beta Band at that time felt like they could have exploded and been that generation's Stone Roses. But they kind of, unfortunately, didn't work out for them, and there was lots of reasons for that. But he was the guy that produced the three EPs from the Beta Band, and I was a massive fan of that. So thought he could be a good choice for Coldplay. But on the first day of pre-production, he was over one side of the studio, Chris Martin was over the other, shouting at each other, and it was just never going to work. So then it was, you know, you're out, you're looking for other producers and you're referencing other records that you like. And there's a guy called Ken Nelson who produced Parachutes, who'd done a band called Gomez at the time. And Ken was very unassuming, Liverpudlian, really, really laid back. I don't think Chris Allison was necessarily laid back, and that might have been why he didn't quite connect with Chris Martin. And Ken did a fantastic job of very simply recording the band without overproducing it, which I think, you know, is a big pitfall of a lot of major label music, and didn't polish it too much, but really bore out the purity and the naivety, which I think makes that album a really classic album. The cover was at the last minute came together. The cover it could have been was awful. I would say it looked like a bit like a tampon advert. It was so dreary, or, you know, something made by some big mass market brand for cosmetics. I think it might have featured a dove or something like that. I'm not sure, but I just remember hating it and thinking it had no relationship with the band. And with big labels, you would have a marketing department, and some marketing people are very good and really understand bands or the band they're working with, and others, it can be a bit tenuous. And at that time, we had pretty much the album ready to go. And I think Chris had a globe that he had on top of his piano when he was playing live shows. And this was before everyone had a phone, really. I think it must have been 99. And we had those disposable cameras that everyone used to have when there was a party that you'd get at a kind of petrol station or something like that. And I think he took a picture of the spinning globe, and that was the shot, and then it became the cover. I think I was so relieved, because it might not be the best cover ever, but it is what it is, and you can read into it that it has a simplicity and it's stylish enough to pull it off. Because I mean, it'd be interesting, and this is all hypothetical, but if you have a classic album, say you take Paul Simon Graceland, but you give it a bad cover, would it still be as resonant? It probably would be, because it's a brilliant bit of music, but classic albums need a good cover. And thank God that happened at the last minute.